This is Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you with the people and places of Southern California. I'm Erica D. Smith, columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and I'm going to be sitting in for Steve Chiatakis this week. I typically write about some of our most pressing public policy problems, putting a face on homelessness and the fight for racial and economic justice. I'm not a native Angeleno, but this city has definitely come to feel like home. I'm thrilled to be joining you this week. Here between Coldwater Canyon Avenue and Ulysses S. Grant High School in North Hollywood, there's not much to see. At first, traffic, some parking spaces, a guy walking his dog, but walk down a bit. Tucked between the streets and the school are two sides of parkland. Between that is an LA River flood control channel. It's basically just dry concrete, but along the western wall is a mural, and it's long, both in length and in the history it depicts. Stand at the beginning of this thing and look towards the horizon, and it just keeps going. It starts with woolly mammoths.
The mural is a running narrative. It's like a ribbon of color. And it begins in prehistory and the first indigenous peoples. And the narrative unfolds decade by decade until you've gone a half a mile of imagery.
That's Judy Baca, acclaimed local muralist, educator, and activist. And this is the Great Wall of Los Angeles. She painted it about 40 years ago. The mural's history ends with the 1964 Olympics. But now Baca has a $5 million grant to bring the mural up to the present day, expand it until it's a full mile long, and more. KCRW's Angel Carreras tells us a story.
Hi, listeners. Maybe you're a lot like me. An uncultured swine. Or, you know, just busy with day-to-day life, don't make it up to North Hollywood often, and somehow you've just never heard of or seen the Great Wall of Los Angeles. And, well, that's what Pete Galindo is here for.
My name is Pete Galindo, and I'm the Great Wall Institute Director at SPARC.
SPARC, S-P-A-R-C, is an acronym of the Social and Public Art Resource Center, which paints socially relevant murals around town. It's a nonprofit founded by Baca, who we'll get back to in a second. But first, the mural. Galindo's showing me around, telling me, well, first about the history of all this concrete around us.
In 1938, there was this massive flood in Los Angeles, and so the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, along with people at the city, decided that it would be a good idea to concrete the channels to avoid those floods. And in this particular channel, the Tujunga Flood Control Channel, they started this process in the 1950s.
That process ended in the 70s, and, well, let's just say the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, they weren't paid to make this look cute.
It was basically a blight in the neighborhood, and so you have Valley College and you have Grant High School and, of course, the neighborhood around it. And so there was just this kind of desert right around this empty channel that would sometimes flood.
So the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers approached Miss Judy Baca. At that point in her career, she'd founded the first citywide mural program and was well known for organizing gangs, at-risk youth, and artists to paint said murals. They asked her to put a pretty Band-Aid on this blight, and she was intrigued. An endless wall? That's endless opportunity. Galindo explains Baca was inspired by her work painting murals with gang members in Boyle Heights.
One of the young men she worked with, named Fernando, was attacked, and he was stabbed multiple times. He survived the attack. But when they got back together and talked about what had happened, she asked him how he was doing. And his response was, "I'm fine, except when I take off my shirt, I have all these scars on my body. And when I look in the mirror, my body is a map of violence."
So Baca and Fernando came up with this idea to tattoo over those scars, transform their meaning. And when she looked at the blight, the Tujunga Flood Control Channel, she had a similar idea. A central metaphor.
My dream about this site when I first stood on the edge of it was that it was created the possibility of a tattoo on the scar where the river once ran.
And of course, what do you paint on that scar? And so she thought it's the disappeared histories of the people who've made up the city.
And those are bountiful on this mural.
It is the only place, for example, that the Chinese massacre is recorded in Los Angeles, or that there is a memorial to the deportation of 500,000 Mexican people in the 30s, or that there is an acknowledgement of Mrs. Laws, who broke the Black Covenant laws by refusing to be moved from her home in Watts in the early 50s. So it's very important that this piece exists.
Baca sourced many of these stories, unknown histories, she says, of indigenous people, people of color, in an oral history type fashion.
It's all discovered materials. When we began this work, it wasn't easy to go to the library and pull down a book that would tell you that story. So we had to go through first source information. We had to do all the research and discoveries to tell the stories of the people.
It's fascinating walking along the mural. Look up and here's a white couple holding a gigantic baby. It represents baby boomers in a picturesque suburbia. Until you look out the window and see the ghosts of Black, Asian, Mexican soldiers who weren't afforded that same suburbia. And here's Dodger Stadium, but it's as a UFO spaceship, landing in Chavez Ravine as working-class Latino Angelinos are beaten and pushed out. It all ends at the Olympics of the 60s. And they all start off as these kind of like one-to-one pieces going for some semblance of realism. Then the deeper in history you get, the further along the mural you are, the more abstract and surreal the pieces become.
I think you see also an artist's process of getting better at doing such a giant scale work. And also accepting that as a woman, I could be a builder of a monument.
She enlisted hundreds of young people to help paint these murals between 1976 and 1983. And those young people and Baca herself were in the blistering heat in this concrete channel.
In that giant concrete hot box, which is unbelievably hot. Like, it can get up to 118 degrees in that space. And to say nothing of the fact that you have to bring in everything you need, from water to toilets to food to, you know, and then you're sort of, you know, sequestered in this space.
Luckily, they won't be doing that this go around. You see, Baca and crew will be developing and painting these murals within the next few years, year-round, elsewhere. Though that last part hasn't exactly been finalized yet.
So if anybody knows where there's a vacant airplane hangar, that's the kind of size we need. We'll be doing 350-foot segments at a time. And we will be able to design and paint in the interior spaces on substrates that then will be placed into the channel.
Baca's nonprofit, Spark, got that $5 million grant earlier this year, and they're going to add on to the work. They plan on adding decades going from the 70s to the 2020s.
It will wrap around as we continue it to the other side of the channel and become a full mile of imagery.
The grant money will also bring lighting in November, a bridge early next year to connect both sides of the channel, and these little QR code stations, think a walking mural tour guide, but in your phone. It's all an interesting modernization at the tail end of what starts with Woolly Mammoths in LA. And it's a capstone project for Baca, who was 28 when she started this project and is 74 now, with a career just as long as her mural.
I had no idea that it was going to snowball into a life's work. The mural itself began to tell me what it wanted, what it needed, and it needs to continue.
And continue it will. For KCRW, this is Angel Carreras.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA, and I'm Erica D. Smith, in for Steve Chiatakis this week. Firefighters in California have made significant progress against the Caldor fire over the weekend, allowing for some evacuation orders to get lifted in and around South Lake Tahoe. Meanwhile, the Dixie Fire is blazing its way to becoming California's biggest ever. As you may know, many of the firefighters fighting these blazes are incarcerated, but there's no direct pipeline for them to get a job as a full-time firefighter once they get out. As climate change continues to fuel larger and more destructive fires, some people are trying to make that pipeline easier. One such organization is called the Forestry and Fire Recruitment Program in Pasadena. It provides career support and training to formerly incarcerated firefighters. Anthony Bracey is the employment coordinator there and joins me now. Hi, Anthony.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So you were formerly incarcerated yourself. Now you work for Cal Fire. Tell us about your path to getting a job in the industry.
The path to get to where I I am now was a bit of some hurdles to overcome and some trials and tribulations and things of that nature. So trying to apply for Cal Fire during my earlier years, thinking that the certifications that I had when I was released would help me, and that actually there wasn't really much to go on so much. I needed other different types of certification to be part of that this department, and which means that I had to now go venture out and seek and find, and I didn't find that out for another approximately 3 years. But prior to that, I was with the U.S. Forest Service, and that wasn't too hard of a challenge. It was just knowing, getting the information and knowing how to apply was the challenge. Anybody can apply. It's just all about like when to apply and things of that nature. And so for myself, even 45 days of being released from the fire camp, I was able to land a job in Ontario, California, working for the U.S. Forest Service.
So we often hear that it's nearly impossible for somebody who's done time to become a professional firefighter, but you're living proof that that's not impossible. So it just takes a lot of work and flexibility, right?
Correct. So it takes, well, flexibility, dedication, but also the determination as well. If this is something you really want to do, you can do it. While I was in fire camp, you know, there were a couple of, you know, fire captains that oversaw the crews that did say, like, yeah, there is opportunity for, you know, folks that are currently incarcerated or in fire camp. Like, hey, you guys can get out and apply and work for whether it's the Forest Service, whether it's, you know, Cal Fire and things of that nature. And, you know, and then at the same time, too, yeah, I have one captain in particular just kind of just encouraged me, you know, keep trying. And that's what I did. So it was just like, okay, I just knocked on one door, closed, knocked on another one, closed, and just kept knocking until finally one opened up. So the spies myth of, oh, you can't get a job. And yes, we cannot work for a municipal fire department, such as like, you know, LA County or LA City or things of that nature, yes, or trying to apply for a local fire department that's, you know, depending on where you're located, no. But you can work for different agencies, such as, like I mentioned, the Forest Service, Cal Fire, Bureau of Land Management, BIA, which is the Bureau of Indian Affairs. These are federal agencies, and contract crews, things of that nature. And so there's opportunities. It's just now just having that knowledge. That's the thing that most people don't know. It's just the knowledge based and things of that nature. And then, you know, that's what FFRP does. You know, we help, you know, streamline that or try to streamline that so folks can get a better understanding of, you know, what options they have for an opportunity to be an inspector of work.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about FFRP or the Forestry and Fire Recruitment Program. How does it work and who exactly is it for?
Well, it's, you know, I think when it was first being brought up, it was, you know, the co-founders, Brandon Smith and Royal Ramey, come with this idea to help streamline folks that were formerly incarcerated, help them pave the way to get an opportunity to get into the fire service. Both worked for the Forest Service. Also, Royal Ramey worked for Cal Fire as well. Became successful at what he was doing within the department, but then eventually stepped down to do Forestry Fire Recruitment Program full time. And so, you know, when applicants such as formerly incarcerated and the ones that are not formerly incarcerated, those that just want an opportunity to see if the fire service is for them, we help those too as well. So we pretty much almost help everybody. So, but, it, you know, primary targets, you know, the formerly incarcerated.
What do you do there?
For myself, you know, I'm the employment coordinator. I am there to help, you know, get them on track as far as their resume goes, make sure that is looking up to par, professional. And then I give them job leads as well. You know, this agency is hiring. Here's the application process. Getting them advice, sharing my struggles of what I had to go through, and let them know that, you know, when you apply, you know, or when you're trying to get in this fire service, it's not, every story is not going to be the same. Like your story, you know, just like in the, you know, journalism, you know, your story of getting into the field is not going to be the same as this person and that person. Same thing in the fire service.
So FFRP, the second group of students just graduated, right?
Correct.
And it's about 30 people.
Correct.
Have most of them been picked up by fire agencies already?
Actually, all 30 have been picked up by various fire agencies. You know, we could start from the U.S. Forest Service to CAL FIRE. We even have some that are majority of our folks got picked up with Pioneer Fire Department, which is based in Northern California, actually where the Caldor fire is located. That fire was right in their backyard, and some of our participants was right there doing initial attack on that fire. And those are our recent graduates. So, you know, and to say that, you know, there's no opportunities, there is.
Are there opportunities in the private sector as well?
Private sector, yes. You know, where there's contract crews and things of that nature, yes. You know, in Oregon right now, there's a company, agency, Grayback Forestry, and they're a type 2 hand crew, same kind of work that we did as an inmate. They do that up there as well, but they get paid to do what we were doing, and they accept folks that were formerly incarcerated, you know, because they understand they've done the work. It's just about, all about, like you were mentioning, being flexible and possibly relocating.
Got it. So fires in California are getting larger and more destructive, even as prison sentences are getting shorter. What do you see as a solution for a state that seems to be strapped for fire resources every year?
Well, I think in a sense, trying to really capitalize on some of the ones that former inmates that are, you know, being released, let's try to capitalize on them, or try to mainstream or try to do a pipeline for some of those that are, if they're still interested in fire. You know, we have FFRP, you know, that we're doing our part, but maybe, you know, someone else too along the way to try to streamline an opportunity for those folks to get hired on, because those are skills and assets that CAL FIRE and the California of Corrections help to, you know, get these folks trained up and things of that nature. But, you know, once they get out, there's, you know, that's a body that could help reduce some of these fires from being big to small. I think something of that nature would be very beneficial in a sense. I think that will be a start of a solution. And so far, you know, Forestry Fire Recruitment Program is doing that. But I feel like we need a little bit more.
Anthony Bracey is a logistics coordinator for CAL FIRE and the employment coordinator at the Forestry and Fire Recruitment Program. Thanks for being here, Anthony.
Yes, thank you.
Moving on now with KCRW's Greater LA. I'm Erica D. Smith. There's infighting among the county board of supervisors over the public messaging of COVID information down in the OC. A few months ago, Orange County officials pulled the plug on public information briefings that updated residents on the latest information about the pandemic. OC Supervisor Katrina Foley took matters into her own hands. She started hosting her own weekly town halls on Zoom with public health officials to answer questions and offer context. But last week, Supervisors Doe and Doug Chafee issued what's being called a gag order for public health officials, barring them from answering questions or providing updates with these town halls. LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano has been following this saga and is here for KCRW's Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Erica.
So first off, tell us about this so-called gag order.
Yeah, it's exactly what it sounds like. So what Katrina Foley, who's a supervisor, who's originally from Costa Mesa, what she's been doing for the past couple of weeks is having these town halls where she would get people from the Orange County Healthcare Agency to talk about COVID. What's going on? What should residents be concerned about? And she was doing it, she says, because the county itself had stopped doing these weekly updates going all the way back to June. And so she's doing this. No one was having a problem with them. Then all of a sudden, Supervisors Andrew Doe and Doug Chafee say, like, no, you can't do that. So we're actually going to say, no, we're going to use our powers as supervisors over your one power as supervisor and say, this is not going to happen.
So if there's no briefings, how are people from the public supposed to figure out what's going on in the county with the pandemic?
It's good for you and I, Erica, because they have to rely on the media, literally. What's going on now, every week, the supervisors, they'll have a weekly media call where reporters can call in. not really ask questions because they're not like that, but they just give the updates of whatever they want. They've been doing it now for the past couple of weeks after a lot of noise from the few reporters left in Orange County saying, hey, you're not doing updates anymore. But you have to be a member of the media to call in. Outside of that, there's no more agenda items on the weekly meetings of the Board of Supervisors, which there was for almost an entire year over the pandemic. Or maybe you could email your supervisor. Let's see if they respond to that, though.
So you mentioned they've been doing, you know, that Supervisor Foley has been doing this for weeks. Why did Supervisors Doe and Chafee decide to do this now?
That's a big mystery, you know, like, and Doug Chafee, by the way, is a Democrat. Andrew Doe's a Republican. So Chafee ideally or supposedly would be on the side of Foley. But I frankly think because Foley was embarrassing them. Foley's a one progressive on that board. You have three other Republicans and Chafee's really a dino, a Democrat in name only. So I'm sure the heat was starting to put on them saying like, hey, why is Foley doing this? Why can't the Board of Supervisors doing that? If you really want to get down to it, they're probably jealous of all the positive attention she was getting.
So is Supervisor Foley giving up or is she doing these town halls even without public health officials?
Oh, no. Foley comes from Costa Mesa, which has had its own battles between liberals and Republicans over the past 20 years. She's a warrioress, a Xena, if you will, of these things. So she's going to continue doing so. More than anything, she's calling out these both Doe and Chafee. And it's interesting because Derek's saying, oh, she's only doing it for, you know, to self-aggrandize herself. Like, oh, you mean so getting actual healthcare agency workers, employees to tell the public about what's going on during this pandemic, which, by the way, is still not over. Foley asking them to do that on a Zoom call, that's somehow self-aggrandizing, but that's the rationale of Doe and Chafee.
Yeah. So, I mean, what does she say in response to that?
She's upset, obviously. I mean, she's saying, look, I'm a supervisor. My constituents are very concerned about this coronavirus pandemic going on. So I want to do as much as possible to give people information. The Board of Supervisors, we're not doing that anymore exclusively. And then also we have weekly media calls, which are not enough. I want to help out my constituents. I'm basically doing my job. And you, Chafee and Doe, are stopping me from allowing me to do my job for my constituents.
So why do you think the supervisors have reduced the number of updates since last year, like in general?
I know up in LA, most of the listeners are KCRW. They know coronavirus is a real thing. Well, here in Orange County, we're still pretending it's not. Especially if you're a politician, you just want to move on. You just want to open everything up. You want to have no more masks anymore. And I've talked about this a lot on Orange County Line, just how the updates that the healthcare agency has given over the past year and a half, they're just like, they're inefficient because we really do not want it to exist. And we think by pretending it doesn't exist. So it's like, hear no evil, speak no evil. There's no coronavirus.
So what's the end game here for Doe and for Chafee? Like, do you think that they could potentially take this even a step further, or are they going to give up?
Oh, no. You're going to see this play out during the Board of Supervisors meetings. You're going to have really sharp words. And again, Foley is one of the few politicians in Orange County in my career that I have actually respected because she has been fighting against some pretty bad people. So you're going to see her, use her powers to be able to stand up for what she feels is right. And in this case, oh, my God, being right is telling the public about everything possible about coronavirus. Wow, what a step. But that's Orange County politics for you.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times with our KCRW Orange County line. Thanks, Gustavo.
Gracias.
That's Greater LA for today. Tomorrow, UC campuses are finding it hard to provide enough housing, and students are freaking out. Also, we'll talk about street medicine, what it's like to provide healthcare to folks living on the street during the pandemic. As always, the show is available at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. You can check it out anytime there. You also can subscribe to the podcast and give us your opinions and story suggestions at the same time, kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarana, Bill Richards, Mario Saavedra, Sue Margulies, Amy Ta, Christine Camito, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordell all help make the show happen today. I'm LA Times columnist Erica D. Smith, and this is Greater LA. Thanks for listening.